Hello and welcome to Book 5 of SAN Security Sec 660. In this section, we're going to cover exploiting Windows for penetration testers. So very similar to what we did in Book 4 with Linux, but now we're moving on to Windows. One good thing is we don't have to go over a lot of that low-level OS architecture and memory translation that we did in Book 4, because most of that still applies here on Windows and to Mac OS and other operating systems. What we do have to go through, though, in this first section are the differences between Linux and Windows. So some Windows-specific architectural things that we need to know about prior to moving forward into the exploitation. It also means that we'll get to exploitation a lot more quickly in this section than we did in Book 4, since we don't have to cover all of that stuff again. So the first thing we're going to go through is Introduction to Windows Exploitation. Then we'll have a quick module on OS protections and compile time controls, and we'll discuss all these different mitigations. We'll then get into Windows Overflow. So we'll do a stack-based overflow like we did on Linux. In this case, though, you're going to be using your Windows 10 virtual machine, so you can't turn off things like ASLR. So we're going to have to manage that from the beginning. But we'll do as close as we can to a very basic stack overflow, but on a Windows 10 vulnerable process. And then we'll look at structured exception handling overwrites. We'll then move our way into dealing with data execution prevention and how we can go about disabling that or changing permissions on a more modern operating system using return-oriented programming, which still works, of course, on your Windows 10 system. At the end of the book, we've got a couple quick modules, one on building a Metasploit module, so how you would take a vulnerability or an exploit and port that into a Ruby script. And then we'll finish up with Windows shell code. And primarily we want to answer the questions, why does it take so much more shell code to do the same thing that you can do in Linux with much smaller amount? So how is that dynamically locating things in memory and such? In the extended hours or bootcamp section, really that's going to be a challenge for you to go and generate your own ROP chain and get that working to change permissions in memory on your Windows 10 operating system with a particular vulnerability that we'll address. So worried about the section, just a reminder that you don't have to be an exploit developer. It doesn't have to be a full-time position to take advantage of this material. Things we want to learn are, how do we repair a broken exploit? Maybe it's something like a memory address has changed, or maybe we need a ROP chain and we know how to do those things now. Or how do we determine bad characters that may exist within a payload? How do we find Stack Overflows if we do want to find this stuff ourselves? We also want to take a look at modern operating system controls and how effective they are. From a defensive perspective, which ones are the best ones to turn on and how much overhead is associated with these? And of course, to understand the internals of Windows and how it differs from Linux and other operating systems. So just a quick reminder that we don't expect everyone to be zero-day bug hunters, although that's, of course, a fun thing to do. So let's dive in our first module here on Introduction to Windows Exploitation. Here's a quick list of our objectives, which we'll just work our way through now. So first off, CPU modes and processor access modes. So Windows, like most operating systems, have two processor access modes. That is Ring 3 and Ring 0. Ring 3 is user mode. Ring 0 is kernel mode. So what happened to Ring 1 and Ring 2? Well, many of the chip makers, processor makers, back when operating systems like Mac and Windows and Linux and all these were coming out, you know, around the same time, the processor makers didn't support more than two rings, at least not all of them. Maybe Intel did, but I'm not sure about the others. So they wanted to stick with something that was going to be usable by multiple processor makers so they're not stuck with a monopoly. If you think about modern architecture now, and you've heard of course, a hypervisor is often seen as ring negative one. So the hypervisor is negative one. That's not a true ring though, right? It's just kind of shimmed in there in between the hardware and the kernel itself. We've kind of stuck this hypervisor in between the two. And then you may have heard of Ring negative two, which is often referred to as UEFI on Windows. Again, these are fictitious rings that they kind of just made up. I would imagine going forward in the next generation of operating systems that this may all change. Same thing on Linux, a shared kernel memory space is, it works in a similar manner where you've got to have a ring zero debugger to be able to see it. The process itself can't see it. On 32-bit Windows, you get 2 gigs of virtual memory to the user mode process and 2 gigs to the kernel. And then on 64-bit, 7 or 8 terabytes of virtual memory for each. So quite a difference. This is a high-level look of, as to the addressing in 64-bit versus 32-bit. So if you look on the right, you can see the differences between 32-bit addressing in user land and kernel land versus 64-bit addressing in user land and kernel land. So you've got a lot more space in 64-bit. In the center of this diagram, you can see the split between ring 3 and ring 0. And down at the bottom in user mode, these are all things that run in user mode. An example would be LSAS. So you may have used tools like Mimikatz in day 2 or book 2 to go and inject into the LSAS process to dump out credentials. And then Credential Guard being a solution for that, a mitigation, where in Credential Guard, they create a secure kernel and this isolated user mode process that's not reachable by even the kernel in the main system. It's a separate area that utilizes Hyper-V technology, and LSAS is now stored over there. So even if you use Mimikatz, if you're administrator or system on the local system, you can't hit that secure kernel and isolated user mode process to be able to inject into LSAS. So Mimikatz is going to fail with Credential Guard. So like that kind of stuff runs out in user mode. All these user mode DLLs like NTDLL and Kernel 32, the user mode side of the Windows subsystem, which is CSRSS.exe, that's the client server runtime subsystem. That's the user mode side of the Windows subsystem that corresponds to kernel mode win32k.sys driver. So like there's that split. Some things run in user land, some things run in kernel land. In kernel land, you've got things like the Windows executive layer of the kernel itself, kernel land drivers that are running in ring zero, and then stuff like the hardware abstraction layer. The abstraction layer abstracts out the physical resources on the system so that developers can write code that talks to the how and not to specific hardware implementations, because that can obviously get you into trouble. An example I always use is if you're old enough to have played Doom and Quake and those kind of games back in, I think it was the 90s, I don't remember, there was a sound card you had to have, and it was Sound Blaster. Why did you have to have Sound Blaster? Because back then, there really wasn't this HAL, and the developers had to write driver code to talk to the specific hardware implementation, and that's hard. So with this abstraction layer, if the Windows operating system supports the hardware, then it should work with that that game that you're playing, regardless of the sound card. Another example would be like think of an ATM machine or a cash machine where that's very specific technology like the dispenser and the keypad and the card reader. Those are all specific pieces of hardware to ATM machines. So somebody's got to write the driver code to talk to that hardware, and there may or may not be an abstraction layer. So that's kind of how that works. Then of course you got the physical hardware. If you want to insert a hypervisor, you would split that physical layer from the hardware abstraction layer in the kernel, and you'd shim that in, you'd put that in between. So an overview, Windows versus Linux, we've got linking and loading. We talked about that in book 4, and we walked through the procedure linkage table and the GOT relationship and how they work in relation to dynamic linking and symbol resolution. On Windows, we've got the import address table, and we'll get back to that. We've got the EAT as well. On Windows, it's PECOF object file format versus ELF. We've got the Windows API, been around for a long time. There's a couple different implementations of that. And basically, we have to, Windows is closed source, right? We don't have the documentation of the kernel there, at least not from Microsoft. So it's not like Linux where we can break and watch, everything's a file and we can watch everything happening. We can use a kernel debugger to watch that stuff, but again, it's closed source. On the screen, we just see this Windows logo, and then all of a sudden we see a login screen. The point being that we've got to go through an API to do anything on Windows. We have the structured exception handling that occurs. We'll get to that at the end of this module, but that is if an exception occurs and it's unexpected and it's not being handled by the code itself, then Windows will come in using the structured exception handling and handle the exception or attempt to, and we'll get to that at the end of this module. Microsoft's always been a threaded operating system or support of that. We've got the Windows object file format, which again is portable, executable, common object file format, or PECOF for short. There's two primary image file types. There's the regular executable format, like Notepad, and then there's DLLs, or dynamic link libraries, like NTDLL and Kernel 32 and MSVCRT. There's hundreds of them. There's the import and export address tables. So the import address table is very similar to the PLT and the GOT on Linux, where we've got this section that has all the different DLLs and functions that a application is dependent on. And those are what need to be linked at runtime. So that would be the import address table. The export address table is something that's more utilized by DLLs, and it's going to export a list of the functions that are available to Windows processes to use. So if we want to do something like open a file, we might have to use an open file function, let's just say, or create file function. And that might be inside msvcrt.dll. So in the IAT of an application would be the dependency on msvcrt.dll and the open file or create file function. And then in msvcrt's export address table, in that list is going to be those function names that can be exported. There's going to be a relocation section, which just like on Linux, if something attempts to map to a location that's already being used in virtual memory, we've got to fix it up or relocate it and record where we've relocated it to. There's some primary sections in the PECOF object file format. One is the DOS executable file section. You'd see a MZ, MZ for Mark Spakowski. 4D5A is that magic number value. We've got a stub area. You may have seen that message before. This program cannot be run in DOS mode. So that's in that location. There's a signature for portable executable. It's just going to be that PE/0/0. We've got a file header section, which specifies the processor requirement, like Intel 386, or it might be for ARM. There's an optional header that's always there, even though it says optional, and it specifies if it's 32-bit or 64-bit file. It's got the image size, the relative virtual address offset, any stack and heap requirements, basically things are going to be, that are going to be needed once you create process. So the loader and such needs this information so it can build the process accordingly. Then we've got some primary sections like that should be familiar from Linux, the text segment, the data segments, resource segment. And we talked on Linux about the BSS segment and the data and the heap and the stack, all these different sections, they exist on Windows as well. The lazy linking concept may also apply, which is, again, we don't resolve a function until it's needed. So we don't resolve a symbol until we need it. There's a couple different debuggers out there that we can use on Windows. There's OliDebug and Immunity Debugger, which are 32-bit debuggers. They haven't been updated in quite some time, at least not in any notable way. They can't debug ring 0. They can only debug ring 3 user mode 32-bit processes. Now, OliDebug was the original one, and then there was a fork that occurred, and the developers split, and Dave Vitale formed Immunity Security and created Immunity Debugger, and some of the original developers stuck with OliDebug. OliDebug is often seen as being more for malware reversing, but they look the same in a lot of ways, so they should feel familiar if you go back and forth between the two. We're going to use Immunity Debugger because of the Python scripting support and the fact that it seemed to stick with like an exploit development kind of perspective or focus. There's also x86 and x64 debug, and there's WinDebug or WinDBG as well, and you can take a look at those too. There's a tool on your USB called PEDump. It was written a long time ago by Matt Pytrek, and it simply dumps out the PECOF sections onto the screen. And it still works today. It should still work today. So it's been around for a while, but it still works. There are other tools that do this as well. And you may or may not choose to use the tool. You don't have to. It's just available to you. So just a quick note. This gets its own slide, so therefore it must be important. I used to not have a slide on this, but students would often ask, well, the addressing in the book doesn't match up to what I'm seeing on my screen. And the reason for that is because ASLR is going to be on, right? And also Windows is much more dynamic by nature. Things move around a lot more. So we don't want to rely on static addresses. And we're going to have to find alternative ways to be able to go and get to locations we want to get to. Similar to how we did the jump ESP on the Linux side, that's kind of where I'm going with this. So just the point being, don't expect the addressing to match up with your system, with what's in the book. Sometimes it will, but a lot of times it won't because of the ASLR on Windows 10 and other factors. But it's completely expected and it's completely fine that that is the case. So on this screenshot, it's a Ali debug screenshot. Now I'm going to use Immunity, but it just really doesn't matter because they look the same and it's the same panes in Windows. But I'll just demo this section with Immunity debugger. Okay, one thing I wanted to point out, and the VM is ready now, is just a quick look here. I'm on Google, and I'm going to type in Net Market Share OS, and it's going to bring up some hits. It's a Net Market Share site. I want to look at the operating system market share. I just think it's important to keep an eye on this thing. So we click on it and wait for it to come up. This is desktop versions, platforms, desktop versions, and it's slowly coming. So what I wanted to see here is desktop versions, and I thought that's what we were looking. Let me click on that again and see if it pops up. All right, here it comes. This took a while. Now, I'm going to change the date range. Right now, it's October 2018 to September 2019. I'm going to change this to like just the last few months here. So maybe July through September. And we run this report again, and now it's a little bit different. This top line is Windows 10. And then the next one down is Windows 7, and then below that is Mac OS 10.14, and I'm reading this from the bottom, Windows 8. Windows XP is still beating Linux. If you look at Windows XP, 1.48%, and then Linux 1.38%. So pretty funny that Windows XP is still winning there. You don't see Vista anywhere in that list, sadly, but we all know the history there. So Windows 10 is at 50.8%. That's pretty strong. 51% of the market is on Windows 10 now. So Microsoft's done a good job evangelizing that and getting people off of Windows 7. If you look at Windows 7, it's at 30%. That is not a small number. The Windows XP of 1.8% is not a small number. Because I think there's something crazy. We can Google this. Let's do that. So we'll go to Google. And of course, this isn't going to be a super exact answer, but let's say how many computers in the world? And it comes back and says 2 billion. So who knows if that's right? That says October 2014. I don't know if that includes mobile devices. It's just proving a point. Let's just say it is 2 billion. And let's say that Windows XP is 1.5% of that 2 billion. That's a big number. Right? And we're talking to millions of systems still running Windows XP. So when someone says, why are we focusing on XP? Well, we're not focusing on XP, but if someone says, why should you still care about that operating system? It's because it's still used in ATM machines and ICS environments and cash machines in medical devices like MRI machines. It's still out there a lot. And so therefore, Vista's still out there. Windows 8 and 8.1 are still out there and still supported. So Windows 7 is a huge operating system that's absolutely going to be around for a long time, for years to come. And Microsoft is even doing their extended service plan option. I think it's something like, I can't remember the exact amount. Something, I want to say like $25 per system per year for the first year. Then it goes up to $50 for the second year. Then it goes up to $100 for the third year. So if you've got a million systems in your environment, I don't know, it's a lot. Let's say it's 10,000 systems. 10,000 times $25. So that's a lot. $250,000 a year you're going to pay the first year because you're not going to upgrade to Windows 10 if you still want support and patches for that OS. So point being, it's going to be around for a while, and it's important to take a look at this information every once in a while. All right, so let's go to that virtual machine, and I'm going to bring up Immunity Debugger, and we're going to open up this little silly POC program called Memtest. And all it's supposed to do is print out the PID number and some other information. Now the debugger, when we open up this program, it immediately pauses execution. We get this prompt here that says some generic message. Let's just say, yeah, we want to continue analysis. And the debugger pauses execution right at the beginning of the process, like probably in the main function or so. So it's loaded it up, but it hasn't actually allowed the program to execute yet. It's just created the process. And you can see in the bottom right, it's paused. Now you can resize these windows and you can change the appearance by going to Options Appearance and change the font and do all kinds of things if you want to do that. So feel free to experiment. What we care about though are these different windows. This first window here in the top left is your disassembler window. So remember in GDB, we had to type disass main. You don't have to do that here. It automatically does it for you and you can scroll up and down on the right to see all the code there. The next window down, it's kind of small and doesn't have anything in it, is the information window. And if you click on different instructions or memory addresses, sometimes it populates the information pane with information about what's going to happen when that line of code executes. The next one down, this is your data pane. By default, it's going to point to the data segment. How do we know that? Well, look at the address it automatically dumped, 00402000. If we click on the memory map here on the M, and we look at that, 00402000, right there, it's the data section in memory. So we can go and look in the information pane or in the memory map to see that. So it does that by default, but you can change it to whatever you want. You can right-click on an address and say follow and dump, and it will dump that section of memory into this window. So you can use it for anything. This window here is your stack pane. So on GDB, we had to type x/20x $RSP or whatever. Here it automatically highlights where the stack pointer is pointing and shows you everything below it. Now you can scroll up, but that would be dead stuff, right? Because this is not in use. The stack pointer points at the top of the stack. So anything up here in this case is not in this particular thread is not relevant anymore. And then up here, we've got our registers pane and you can see their general purpose registers. And they're all populated. We've paused execution and it's fine. If you're ever looking at this pane up here and it just disappears and goes blank, it probably just means that the thread died and you just need to go and click on T for threads and double click on a thread that's still active. And that could potentially happen at times. On the very top, I know it's hard to see. It tells you which module you're currently in and what's being dumped to the disassembler pane. In this case, it's memtest 2. If we click on E for executable modules, it's really small, let me increase the size. You can see that those are all the modules that are loaded, the main executable image, and then these DLLs. You can double click on one of those DLLs and it will automatically disassemble that for you and you can scroll up and scroll down. Sometimes people get stuck and they resize their windows and all of a sudden the screen ends up being confusing and they've lost their disassembler pane or their main window. Just click on C. That'll bring you back to your CPU window and expand that out and there you're back on the main window again. So continuing on, what else do we want to look at? These controls up here are pretty intuitive. You've got restart the process, stop it, continue or play, and then pause. And then these little buttons to the right of that are step into, step over, kind of like how we type things like step instruction or next instruction in GDB. And then all the letters on the far right, they all mean things like the log window, executable modules, the memory map, the threads, the windows, the handles, the CPU, so on and so forth. You can click on them and have a look at the different windows. So there's hotkeys for a lot of things, there are buttons for a lot of things, and then you can go and drive through the menu options and find some of these same things there when you need to. To set a breakpoint, you can click on a memory address and just hit F2, and you can see it toggles on and off when you press F2. Or you can right click, go down to breakpoint, and then toggle it that way. You can set hardware breakpoints, which utilize the hardware registers. You can set conditional breakpoints and say, only break at this address if the accumulator register is equal to -1. And that stuff can be very useful, giving you more granular level of control. So what we want to do is walk through a function being called because it's going to give me the opportunity to show you a couple of important structures like the thread information block and the process environment block. So if we scroll down here in the main executable, I'm looking for a function call to getPID. And it's right there. So see that function call to getCurrentProcessID? I'm going to set a breakpoint there by hitting F2. And then we're going to tell the process to run. So I click on the play button and we immediately hit the breakpoint. You can see we're paused at the bottom right. The bottom left, it says breakpoint. So at this point in the information pane, it says you're about to jump. By executing this, it's going to take you eventually to msvcrt.dll to the getPID function. So I'm going to hit F7 to do a single step, or you can go to debug and say step into, like that. And it takes us into the import address table in the main executable. And this is going to tell us to jump to the resolved address in msvcrt.dll for getPID. So we take this jump by hitting F7, and now we're in msvcrt. And notice what it says, jump to the double word pointer in kernel 32, get current process ID. So for whatever reason, maybe the code once existed inside msvcrt, but they moved it to kernel 32, so it's just a little jump they added in here. Very dynamic in the Windows world. So we say F7, and now it takes us there, and it says, jump into MS WinCore process threads, get current process ID. So we say, okay, whatever, hit F7. We're still in kernel 32, but it now says, you're going to jump into kernel base.dll to the get current process ID. So yet again, we're being thrown around. So we F7, and now we're in kernel base.dll to the actual location where the code exists. Now, what we're trying to do is get the process ID of the current process. This first line of code says move into EAX, so it's Intel syntax, dereference FS segment register offset 1-8. How do I know it's dereferencing? Because we're saying go to the FS segment register, and we've got square brackets around it. Go to that offset, and we're going to take what's there and dereference that into the accumulator register in this case. Well, the information pane shows us what the FS segment register points to, 7FFDE000. That ends up being, because remember I said previously, the FS segment register points to the thread information block of the current thread. So what FS points to is a thread information block for the current thread. And that's what's being moved into. It just so happens that at offset 1-8 within the 16-bit offset pointer for FS, it's a pointer to the thread information block itself. So I know it's kind of weird, but since FS can't hold a full 32-bit address, it's pointing to an offset, and then at offset 18 at that location in the TIB is the full 32-bit address of the TIB. So we're moving that into the accumulator register. So if you look to the far right where EAX is and we hit F7, now the address of the thread information block has been loaded into the accumulator register. And if we look at this in the memory map, 7FFDE000, double click it, this is the thread information block. So expand that out, you can see that offset 0 within the TIB points to the SCH chain. Then it had the top and the bottom of the thread stack. At offset 1-8 is the self-referencing pointer. At offset 3-0 is the process environment block pointer. So there's all kinds of good stuff stored in here. So let's go back to the main window. The next instruction says, dereference the TIB offset 2-0. So if we go back to that other window, offset 2-0 is BA0 in this case. BA0. That's going to end up being the process ID. So if we bring up a calculator and we see BA0 in hex and we convert that to decimal, 2976. Now let's look at the task manager and we add on the PID and 2970, I believe it was. Oh, 2976. Sorry. That's what we had, not 70. So 2976. And that is the PID number for the memtest program. So what it's doing now, as you can see, is grabbing the offset within the thread information block as to where the PID is stored. And it's loading that into the accumulator register. So we let that happen. Now it's in the accumulator register. Remember in book 4, when we talked about the accumulator register and how it's commonly used to return something back from a function call. In this case, it's returning back the PID. So we let the return pointer, let the return instruction execute. And now we're back inside the memtest module. And you can see what's going to move next. So it says move the accumulator register value. So take the PID and move it to the top of the stack plus 4. So if you look at the stack window at plus 4, you're going to see the PID get written there. So there's the PID. And now it says move this memory address to the top of the stack. So we let that happen, and what that ends up being is a pointer to the string PID is %D. So now it knows that these are the arguments to the printf function that's about to be called. I hit F9 to let it continue, and here's that shell in the background, and it printed out PID is 2976. So it all makes sense, and it's a really good way to kind of see how these structures and such are utilized, like the TIB and the PEB, inside a process. So I'm going to close out the debugger here. And that's not an exercise or anything, but you, of course, can feel free to go and walk through that. Now, how it's going to behave on Windows 7 versus 10 versus XP is going to change, because they may have moved the location of the get PID function depending on the operating system. And they have the ability to do that. It's not so static like it is on Linux, as you saw. So the slides here are just walking you through what I demoed. I'd rather demo it than walk through the slides when I can. So let's just skip over this. And then we get to slide 26. It says the Windows API. I said earlier that in order to get Windows to do anything, you've got to have a function call to do it for you. And in user mode, if you're trying to do something privileged, it's just stub code. It's just a little wrapper that takes in some arguments from you, and it follows some call chain, goes in through ntdll.dll, which does a sysenter into the kernel. And then the kernel is going to be what actually executes that code if it's something privileged. So you can expect a lot of that functionality to just be stub code that you're interacting with when you're writing Windows applications. An example of something privileged is when you're crossing a trust boundary. So if you need to write something to the file system or open something from the file system, that's a privileged operation. So therefore, it wants to inspect your token, and it wants to validate that you've got their rights and the permissions are set accordingly. So we already talked about the TIB, so we can kind of skip over this. It's every thread gets one, and it's just a little structure in memory that stores some important things that are needed. The next slide talks about the process environment block. Well, we know that offset 30 in the TIB is where a pointer to the PEB is stored, and that becomes useful to shellcode, as you'll see at the end of this book. But it's got information per process, things like the image base address, the heap addressing, the imported modules, so like kernel 32 and kernel base and ntdll, those are DLLs that are always loaded into every process, and it's got a list of all of those. And in fact, it's in order. So the third listed module in the PEB, every single Windows process, is going to be kernel 32. Shellcode likes that too. It's reliable information. There used to be, because the PEB is writable, there used to be this pointer that was statically stored at offset 20 called the fast PEBLOCK pointer. And what you could do when you had a write what where attack is you could overwrite that pointer and get code execution when the process goes to terminate itself, when it goes to exit. Just a little trick you used to be able to do back in the Windows XP days. So structured exception handling is quite fascinating. It's different on 32-bit versus 64-bit. On 32-bit, its behavior was exploitable. On 64-bit, it's not that way anymore. It used to be that the pointers to the exception handlers were stored on the stack. And if you did a buffer overflow, you could overwrite these pointers, and when an exception occurs, your pointer gets called because you overwrote it. And it was really easy to do, and we're actually going to do it because we're going to deal with a 32-bit process on our 64-bit Windows 10 system that still allows us to get code execution that way. On 64-bit, though, they moved it to inside the actual header files and into the PE file itself, and it's just not available to overwrite like it used to be, sadly. So what is it used for? If a programmer defines a exception handler in the code and it handles an exception, great. But what happens if there's some kind of segmentation fault or access violation? Windows needs to handle that. And instead of abruptly terminating, they put into this little process that says, let's try a series of exception handlers per thread, and let's see if they can handle the exception. And if they can, great. If they can't, we'll end up gracefully terminating the process. And here's a little diagram as to how it kind of works. So if a thread experiences an exception, it's going to go and dereference FS offset 0, which is a pointer to the SEH chain. And on 32-bit, that chain resides on the stack. And I'll show you this in a debugger shortly. So if there is a buffer that's vulnerable and we can overrun that buffer and keep writing downward, we can overwrite one of these pointers. And they're coupled. There's something called the NSCH pointer, and then there's the SE handler pointer itself that points in the DLL code. So let me kind of show you this in a debugger so it can add some context. So I'll bring up Immunity, and we're going to open up Internet Explorer with Immunity Debugger. And we'll let this continue. The browser should come up. And there's the browser. And I'm just going to click on T for threads. And you can see, I know it's very small, but those are all the threads. And you'll see that they appear and that they disappear at times because threads sometimes die. So we'll just double click on a random thread. And on the stack, if you scroll down a bit, you see this SE handler and pointer to next SEH record. So in this particular stack, if you were to look at the thread information block, FS offset 0 is going to point to this address on the stack that says pointer to next SEH record. That's going to be a linked list that points on the same thread stack to the next handler on this stack. The address below it, that's going to be DLL, pointer to DLL code where the handler actually exists. So if we right click on that and say follow in disassembler, it's taken us to kernel-based.dll to the actual function that, the handler code. If this handler can handle the exception, great. If it can't handle the exception, we're going to do a callback to the NSCH pointer on the stack. We're going to walk it, follow on stack, and then we get to the next one. In this case, there were only two handlers on this particular thread stack, and we've reached the end. We know it's the end because instead of being another address on the stack, it's a negative one. And below that is going to be a pointer into NTDLL to the global exception handler that will terminate the process gracefully. So that's kind of how SEH works from a high level. And we'll exploit it in this section here, so you'll get much more familiar with it. So finally, just because I didn't know where else to put it, WOW64 is a emulator that allows 32-bit processes to run on a 64-bit operating system. So Windows 10 64-bit can run 32-bit applications and processes because of WOW64. It's nothing more than an emulator, like I said, and it emulates the environment that's necessary, and it works as a broker. So when your 32-bit process in its emulated environment needs to do something and it has to talk to the kernel, it's going to go through this kind of broker or whatever you want to call it that will translate the request over to 64-bit and then get the response, convert it back over to 32-bit, so it all just works. And if you look at your file system, if it's a 64-bit operating system, there'll be a folder called syswow64, and then there's going to be system32. So if you go into Windows or C:\Windows syswow64, that's going to be where all your 32-bit environment is located, and system32 will be where your 64-bit environment is located. So a little bit interesting, but it's important to understand that there. So we're at the end of this module. In the next module, we're going to get into exploit mitigations, and we'll quickly fly through that. But just recapping, there's some notable differences between Windows and Linux, and we just covered some of those that we need to be aware of to get through this book. Now, there's a great set of books out there, the Windows Internals books from Alex Ionesco and Mark Rusinovich and Solomon, and they're fantastic resources. And in fact, Alex Ionesco has two Windows Internals courses that are 5 days long each. And that's how deep you can get in all this stuff. So there are some obvious differences. We took a look at a function being called so we could see where the TIB is and how we find that. We talked about structured exception handling. So a lot of good stuff that will allow us to move forward. So before we get into exploitation, let's talk about Windows operating system protections and compile time controls. So our objectives for this module is to go over the various exploit mitigations that Microsoft has rolled out over the years. Now, there's a couple of things I want to say before we get started. That is, on Linux, on Book 4, we covered a few of these mitigations, which are relatively similar to how Windows has implemented them. But there may be some subtle changes, and we'll talk about those when we get to the appropriate slide. Also, on the Linux side, you'll see some repeating information in this module because I wanted to make sure that we keep it all in one place, especially if you're on taking the GXPN exam. It doesn't make sense for you to have to flip through the book if it's a question specifically about exploit mitigation. So if we see one that's specific to Linux, we can skip through that pretty quickly after doing a recap. Another thing I want to say is there's a exploit mitigation toolkit you may have heard of from years ago called EMIT, which is the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. Now that went end of life just over a year ago and was replaced by something called Exploit Guard on Windows 10 Enterprise. And I believe it's been rolled out into other versions as well. Now that is kind of like their flagship exploit mitigation toolkit that I'll talk a little bit about it when appropriate, but from a high level, a lot of that stuff is not turned on by default. You've got to go in as an administrator and turn that on because they want to make sure they're not going to negatively impact your applications, but they also want to give you the power to turn those mitigations on. There absolutely may be overhead associated with them, or some of them may cause problems with your applications. So it's really important to understand them. And unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of documentation on many of these mitigations. So let's go through this module and talk about a couple of other items when appropriate. So first off, this is a Venn diagram that I put together. Now the category on the top that says Exploit Guard, that used to say Application Optional Controls, because I believe I would say prior to Windows 7, so Vista and XP, some of these mitigations, the application could actually choose whether or not it wanted to participate in a particular control. Much of these controls get set at compile time, and there are flags, and you may remember that from book 3 in the Python section. There are these DLL characteristics and other type of flags that specify whether or not a application is supposed to participate in something like rebasing or others, or control flow guard. And as we said then, if you've got access to a local system and can make changes to an application, it kind of defeats the purpose from an exploit development perspective, unless you're going about testing your exploits. But prior, or regardless of that, there are some controls, depending on the operating system, that the application could actually choose whether or not it wanted to participate in something. And one example of that is data execution prevention. And I'll show a demo later on in this book against an older target, just so you could see how easy it was to disable some of these controls due to the fact that these critical APIs or function calls were available inside NTDLL, and you could simply replay them to turn a control off like dep for the whole process, which is kind of crazy. So point being, they mitigate or deprecated, I should say, some of these application optional controls. So I kind of threw away that category from this Venn diagram and replaced it with Exploit Guard. Now this is not something that Microsoft put together as far as this Venn diagram is concerned. It's something that I just kind of put together, and I felt that Exploit Guard has become its own unique category. And some examples of mitigations that fall under Exploit Guard are bottom-up ASLR, arbitrary control guard, or arbitrary code guard, sorry, core isolation, block untrusted fonts. And again, we're not going to dive into too much detail specifically on Exploit Guard, but let's talk about those ones on the top since I've got them there. So first off, if you remember Dooku, the infamous campaign that targeted, I believe, the Iranian nuclear facilities, that vulnerability was a font-based vulnerability, and a Word document was sent to the target environment, and if they opened up the Word document, there was a malicious font that exploited a kernel vulnerability and allowed for remote code execution. So what Block Untrusted Fonts would do is it would say only fonts located in the C Windows Fonts folder are permitted to be loaded, so no third-party fonts, but you have to turn that on. Core isolation is another one which acts very similar, if not exactly like Credential Guard. If you're familiar with Credential Guard, then you probably know that it utilizes Hyper-V on Windows 10 Enterprise 64-bit to isolate the LSAS process in a secure kernel. So there's a second kernel running, and there's a user mode out there as well, and that's where the LSAS process is running. It's called isolated user mode. And there's a broker that you would have to go through to be able to get to the LSAS process running in the separate kernel instance. And even if you have a kernel debugger, like with Windebug, you can't get over to the isolated user mode or the secure kernel to play around. So if someone were to get system on the normal operating system and they were to run a tool like Mimikatz, the LSAS process running in user mode in the normal instance doesn't have anything in it. And so therefore Mimikatz is going to fail. Core isolation allows other Windows sensitive services to run in that similar manner. Bottom up ASLR. just from a high level, we all know what ASLR is, how it randomizes things. Well, this has to do with when a DLL gets rebased, we can combine that rebasing with BASLR, which is going to take away some of the ability to determine where a DLL might be loaded due to other DLLs placement in memory. So if you've got a bunch of DLLs that have been rebased, they're going to be successive in memory. And with bottom-up ASLR, it does a little additional randomization to try and prevent predictability. And then arbitrary code guard, these controls act similar. Again, a lot of these come from Emmet as well. Some of them are unique only to exploit guard. But these are controls that do things like, let's make it so you can't change permissions on the stack. So if somebody's trying to do a ROP or based attack and they're trying to change permissions on the stack so that their shell code can be executed, let's prevent that. Other controls may do things like, well, let's look at the imports table. And if someone's trying to modify an entry in the imports table, when we go to call that function, make sure that the address of that function falls within the loaded base address of that module from which that function or where that function is located, right? If it's supposed to be, I'm making this up, but let's say it's a function called write file or open file, and that is supposed to be an msvcrt.dll. Let's make sure that before we call the function from the imports table after it's been linked, the address actually exists within the module where it should, that someone hasn't hooked the imports table to try to get control. That's kind of some of the examples of the controls you would see in exploit guard. But again, you've got to go and enable those and you've got to test them first to make sure it's not going to have any negative implications. For OS controls, those are controls that have to be supported by the operating system. And you'll see sometimes that both the operating system has to support the control and it has to be compiled in at compile time. So an example would be control flow guard that you see there on the bottom left. That has to be supported by the OS, like Windows 10 or Windows 8, and the DLL has to have been compiled to support control flow guard. And it's one of those things where any weak link in this chain, if one single module doesn't participate in a control, even if all the other modules participate, it may break the whole thing. Others that we'll talk about coming up in the slides, DEP, SEHOP, ASLR, so I'm not going to cover those now. Compile time controls, obviously the compiler is inserting code. A really good example of that are stack canaries, or Microsoft calls them security cookies. So this is a high-level timeline. This is something I put together for an RSA presentation years ago, and it's certainly not, doesn't account for all mitigations. It's not comprehensive by any means, but it's some of the notable mitigations. And if you look back at Windows XP Service Pack 2, you can see DEP, Safe SEH, Safe Unlink, Canaries. That was a big deal. Prior to XP Service Pack 2, exploit mitigations were pretty much non-existent. So when XP Service Pack 2 came out, it was quite a big change. And those controls got added in. So that was a huge shift for the security model at Microsoft. Then 2007, we all remember the infamous Vista coming out. It wasn't a very successful operating system. And that's due to the fact that XP was a loved operating system. There are still plenty of people using XP. I think it's still something like almost 2% of the market is, or 1.5 to 2% of the market is on XP. That accounts for tens of millions of systems. So either way, a very, very popular operating system. So when Vista came out, it was quite a change. They introduced UAC, the user account control or access control, and that annoyed people because every time they tried to do something that was considered privileged, they got a prompt to enter their credentials, and it just, again, people weren't really interested in moving from XP at that time. So Microsoft made some changes to Vista. Now that did include things that were kind of transparent to the user, like address space layout randomization, low fragmentation heap, SEHOP. These were mitigations that were, and LFH, for example, is not necessarily just a mitigation. It was a replacement of the front end heap allocator, but it had some mitigations built in. So this stuff, again, was transparent, and the user likely didn't appreciate it, but the front end of Vista is what annoyed some people. So Microsoft worked hard to try to make a bit of the UAC a bit more transparent and make it a little more user-friendly. They renamed Windows Vista Windows 7, but the engine underlying, you know, the kernel itself was majority just Windows Vista, and Windows 7 was a very successful operating system. But Emmet came out around the same time as Windows 7, and that was the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit. And you could, of course, apply that to earlier operating systems as well. And that falls in line with some of those mitigations we just talked about with Exploit Guard. And it was an optional third, you know, add-on that you could install. And at first, it wasn't really loved because I don't believe there was GPO support. It was a little difficult to use and not a lot of great documentation. And then over the years, people started to adopt it a bit more, but it never really took off and got too popular. And so for whatever reason, Microsoft decided to discontinue it at some point, and Exploit Guard came out with Windows 10, but we'll get back to that. So Windows 8 came out in 2012. And again, when people started liking Windows 7 a lot, and a lot of people weren't really interested in a change. And Windows 8, Microsoft made the choice to remove the start button. You probably remember that. And they had this tile menu. And I remember a lot of people were getting stuck in the tile menu and didn't know how to get out. There was no start button to click. And little things like that, or though it seems little, ends up being a huge problem. And people decided not to use Windows 8 for the most part. It wasn't a very successful operating system compared to XP or 7. Some mitigations came out, though. Null pointer dereferencing, guard pages were added in. We'll talk about these controls when appropriate, but like a null pointer dereference protection means that if we can somehow get the instruction pointer to go to memory address 0, page 0, and that's in user mode, so we can allocate code there per process if we've got that ability, and we could put shell code at page 0 when, especially if it's in kernel mode, if there's not a control like supervisor mode execution prevention, then the kernel code execution would go to user mode page 0 and execute shell code as supervisor, and that's obviously dangerous. So Windows 10 came out in 2015, and they introduced Control Flow Guard, backported that into Windows 8. We'll talk about what CFG is. And Windows 10 at first was, I don't think it was as bad as, say, when Windows 8 or Vista came out. People liked Windows 10 generally, and it's done quite well. Microsoft's done a great job evangelizing the product and supporting it and coming out with new builds and having fall and spring creators updates. And it's just a very lively operating system with a lot of great features. So it's doing quite well. I believe it's just over 50% of the market now, with Windows 7 being around 30% of the market. Obviously, this will change. You're going to see Windows 7 likely drop down pretty aggressively as companies choose not to pay for that support model. And if companies aren't paying for that support model to get patches going forward, then that means they're not getting patched for the most part. Now, Microsoft has been known to release patches occasionally for operating systems they're no longer supporting when it's something that's critical. But for the most part, you know, we need to get off of those Windows 7 operating systems. But we are probably going to see it for quite some time, at least till 2023, as that support option's still there. And to be fair, I mean, I may not be accurate here, but I remember reading an article that said something like $25 per node for the first year, $50 on a second year, $75 or $100 on a third year. I mean, that's quite expensive. If you're a large organization and you've got 100,000 systems and you're hitting year three, and let's say it's $100 per system, 100,000 systems, I mean, you're talking some serious money, $10 million, whatever that is, plus, I mean, it's a ton of cash. So, but if you compare that to how much it's going to cost an organization to pay for the Windows 10 Enterprise License upgrade, as well as what that takes internally in terms of support and rolling that out to such a large number of systems, you know, you can see there's definitely some decision making to be made. So anyway, let's move on. We could talk about that all day. So Linux WXOR execute, that's just dep on Linux. We talked about that in book 4. We kind of avoided it with doing return to libc, but this is that control that says we allocate pages of memory, and it's a processor supported control or enforced control. It's got to be supported by the operating system, and we get that NX or XD bit that says this page is executable or not. You can't be both writable and executable. And then Windows, of course, we just call it dep, data execution prevention. Started with Windows XP, Service Pack 2, and Server 2003. It works pretty much identically. There's really not anything additional to say, other than we can, using return-oriented programming, make a call to a critical function, or a RET, to a critical function like virtual protect or virtual alloc or others we'll discuss later, and change permissions in memory. So SafeSCH, this is a pretty weak control, and It's a compile time control. And the idea is when a thread, when there's an exception under the context of a thread, we go to that thread's thread information block or TIB, and we dereference offset zero, or if we take the pointer stored at offset zero from FS, that's the stack location where the first NSEH pointer is. And I'm going to demo this in a moment here to kind of show you a little bit more. I believe we might have already done it previously, but that's okay. We can refresh now. But then I'll also, to give me an opportunity, I'll turn on init, or it would work the same way if it was exploit guard, but the control I'm going to turn on is SE hop. So structured exception handling overwrite protection. And when we get to that slide, I'll just show you both at the same time. That way you can see what that control is actually doing to change things. But safe SEH by itself is a compile time control where, let's say you're compiling a DLL and that DLL has five exception handlers that were written into it. At compile time, a table of pointers to those valid handlers is going to get created. And the idea is if an attacker overwrites the structured exception handling pointer, which is supposed to point into a DLL, but they overwrite it with a ROP gadget, something like a pop ret that we'll talk about soon, then what happens is before control gets passed to what should be the exception handler, it's going to compare the address of the handler with the table, the safe SEH table that was built at compile time. And it's going to say, is this address that's being pointed to in this DLL, is it one of the registered handlers? If it's not, then terminate the process. If it is one of the registered handlers, then everything should be okay. And from a high level, that sounds like a good idea, like not a bad control. But the problem is it only protects DLLs which have registered handlers. So if, and that were compiled with safe SEH. So if a developer didn't compile that DLL with safe SEH, it just ruins the whole protection. It breaks the whole thing. Because again, all modules have to be protected. Or if an attacker is able to point somewhere outside of a DLL where there is no safe SEH to executable memory, then they can bypass the whole thing. All in all, it's not worth spending any more time to talk about this control. It's just really easy to get around. And you're going to do that in an exercise in this book.